for today's WHFR Journal. Continuing our presentation of women who were important, today's program for the Journal will focus on women architects.
Building Speak, stories of pioneering women architects. A new special from the Kitchen Sisters, the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, and PRX. Trailblazers, groundbreakers, skyscraper visionaries, women who changed the skyline and the built environment that surrounds us today.
The city first fell down and then burned up. Something like 30,000 buildings were destroyed.
The fire took off through the whole city. They said it was like Pompeii. Julia Morgan was determined to bring it back.
Julia redesigned, re-engineered the Fairmont Hotel, which had been a brand new building, had been open for a month or something before the earthquake.
She was the only one who knew anything about reinforced concrete. They tried to bring some East Coast architects who might know reinforcing, but the guy who was supposed to come got killed in a duel.
Striking, surprising stories of design, vision, and love. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. Back in a moment.
Over 60 and retired? Making ends meet, especially at the supermarket, is tough. BenefitsCheckup.org is a free website that helps you pay for food, medicine, even utilities. Visit BenefitsCheckup.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Building Speak, a new special from the Kitchen Sisters and Brandy Howell. A new hour of stories of pioneering women architects from across America. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. This special is inspired by the podcast New Angle Voice from the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation and their intriguing website, Pioneering Women of American Architecture. Buildings speak for themselves, said Julia Morgan, the first woman allowed to study architecture at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris in 1895. The first accredited female architect in California with over 700 building designs to her credit, one of the early wizards of reinforced concrete, Julia Morgan changed the tide. The architect and designer of William Randolph Hearst's infamous castle was overshadowed, almost written out of the history books after her death in 1957.
The first time I heard her name was when I went on a tour of the castle. That was in 1976. When we were on the tour, they said, a woman built Hearst Castle, but we don't know anything about her. It was astonishing. It was at that point that I left my freshman composition students and started to work at Hearst Castle.
Little was known about Julia until a few committed historians and architects set out to change all that.
I'm Victoria Kastner. I was for many decades the official historian at Hearst Castle. I've written the first personal biography of Julia Morgan, titled Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect.
Story number one, Finding Julia Morgan.
In 2018, an editor at the New York Times emailed asking me if I wanted to write an obituary of Julia Morgan, whom he referred to as the Hearst Castle architect. I wrote back immediately and said I would love to. I'd actually checked on some other female architects to see if the Times had covered their deaths, but it never occurred to me to check on Morgan. I'm Alexandra Lang. I'm a design critic, and I wrote the overlooked obituary for Julia Morgan in the New York Times.
There's a big burden placed on Julia Morgan to be absolutely everything, because she was the first in so many things, right? I'm Karen McNeil. I'm a historian and longtime scholar of Julia Morgan. Julia Morgan graduated with a degree in civil engineering in 1894 from UC Berkeley. That was the closest she could come to any sort of architectural training in California. Around the time she graduated from Berkeley, she met Bernard Maybeck. He was a charismatic character. He'd studied at the École des Beaux-Arts. He wore capes and was vegetarian. He taught the first architecture courses at Berkeley beginning in the fall of 1894, just after Morgan graduated. And he invited her to join a group of young men to seminars at his home. Basically, all of them went off to Paris to study at the École des Beaux-Arts, which at the time was the most important architectural school in the world. Bernard Maybeck encouraged her to go to Paris. She arrived there in June of 1896. This was weeks after the faculty had decided, yes, women, you may attend classes at the École. That decision came about because a group of women unionized, the Union of Women Painters and Sculptors. They fought a 7-year battle against the École just for the right to take courses. Morgan landed in Paris right when the doors opened. She got to know these women, and they very much supported her. They kept organizing, they kept pressuring the faculty to allow women to take entrance examinations. And finally, the faculty said, okay, ladies, you can take the entrance examinations. Her first opportunity was only 5 weeks after the examinations had been opened. She was actually a figure of fascination. Just as she was taking the exams, it was already in the papers. This young American woman wanted to pursue architecture. Long story short, she failed, but she took that in stride. Everybody failed at least once. In October of 1898, she took the examinations for a fourth time. She was 13th out of almost 400 applicants. She was almost 27 years old.
On a rainy day, she would sit inside a church and sketch. On the weekends, she would travel, paying attention to the relationship of buildings, the relationship of light and space and color and form.
I'm Julia Donahoe. I'm an architect and an attorney and general contractor. And I served on the National Board of the American Institute of Architects. I was in a position to nominate architects for the Gold Medal in Architecture. And that's how I got involved with Julia Morgan.
Morgan met Phoebe Hearst in Paris when Phoebe was visiting to meet all these architects who were competing to design the new campus for the University of California. Phoebe took a shine to Morgan, and when she came back to California, Phoebe hired her to remodel her estate. They just had this enduring working relationship. By the time Morgan came back to the United States, California women were really gearing up into all sorts of organized activities. She was 30, her friends were in their 30s. They had time, money, and education to organize around suffrage, women in higher education, urban development and beautification, juvenile delinquency. You end up with Julia Morgan designing a landscape for those women.
So what we're looking at now is the bell tower, which was built in 1904. And around the oval from that is the Margaret Carnegie Library, built in 1906. It says, designed by architect Julia Morgan, April 14th, 1904. And then on the other side, it says, El Campanile is the first concrete reinforced structure built west of the Mississippi. Having a clock on a tower seems pretty mundane now, but back then that was kind of like the iPhone of its day, very futuristic. I'm Karen Feeney. I'm the campus architect.
During the construction of the Campanile, she was in this battle of wills and egos with the builder, a guy named Bernard Ransom. His father was the leading patent inventor, reinforced concrete guru in the United States. Bernard Ransom saw himself as the heir apparent. He did not like working for this young woman who wanted to call herself an architect. He had gotten top billing at the ceremonies at the unveiling of the Campanile. The 1906 earthquake and fires decimated San Francisco, as well as damaged significant portions of surrounding areas. One structure that did not fall and was not damaged in any way was the campanile at Mills College. When the campanile survived the earthquake without a scratch, it wasn't Ransom who was remembered. It was Morgan. So Julia Morgan's daring reinforced concrete campanile survived. Reinforced concrete had been something, a source of debate. It was mostly associated with industrial infrastructure, but Morgan saw the potential for beauty in it because of its infinite plasticity. So many architects who had been hesitant in using reinforced concrete for pretty buildings went to Mills College. It became like this laboratory to understand how reinforced concrete could be used. That really catapulted Julia Morgan's reputation as a serious architect and engineer who designs not just pretty buildings, but buildings that will last for generations.
She launched her career, and shortly after she launched her career, the earthquake happened.
The city first fell down and then burned up. 400,000 people were homeless. Something like 30,000 buildings were destroyed.
The fire took off through the whole city. They said it was like Pompeii. Julia Morgan was determined to bring it back.
Julia redesigned, re-engineered the Fairmont Hotel, which had been a brand new building. It had been open for a month or something before the earthquake.
The whole world was in ruins, and she was the only one who knew anything about reinforced concrete. They tried to bring some East Coast architects who might know reinforcing, but the guy who was supposed to come got killed in a duel. So then they saw the Mills College Tower sitting there, and they were like, wow, you know, that's reinforced concrete, and it didn't fall down. She told all of San Francisco, we can rebuild the city. To this day, a lot of her buildings are still standing because she really was an engineer. She knew what she was doing.
When W.R. approached her, William Randolph, first after he received his inheritance, which was in the spring of 1919, he explained to her that he was tired of camping in tents and thought he was getting a little old for that, and he was thinking of building a little something in San Simeon, a modest 6 months, a single cottage, be over in no time. But within a month, we were going on the grand scale, and that's the scale at which W.R. Hearst operated. J.M. wasn't just the architect, she was also the interior designer and the landscape architect, and essentially the contractor for Hearst Castle. She made an astonishing 568 train trips from San Francisco down to San Simeon. She was 47, she was about 5'2", I think, with the assistance of a hat. She'd spend the whole day Sunday and meet with Hearst. One of her draftsmen, he said, I went along with her and we got back to San Francisco on Monday morning and I was exhausted. And she walked right into the office and went to work. And that's how she did it. Hearst Castle was a very romantic place. It was the site of a great love story between Hearst and his companion, Marion Davies. It was a love story about his childhood and his parents and California. It might be 2 a.m. in New York, and he's trying to get an edition out, because that's when he worked as a newspaper man. He could send a telegram. Dear Miss Morgan, I've just bought some columns. Let's talk about where to put them at the ranch. And she could write to him about the alligator pears, which is what they called avocados back then, and how the sunset was blue beyond imagining. He was completely and utterly respectful of her and supportive of her authority. This was a collaboration between two remarkable people. They had a long association, and in many ways, I would even say a romantic one. It's long as it is clear that I'm talking about a platonic romance, you know, the romance of two, as Walter Stahlberg, who was one of her top employees, said, two long-distance dreamers.
You're listening to Building Speak. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. More about Julia Morgan in one moment. Stay put.
You're listening to a special presentation of the WHFR Journal from the series Buildings Speak.
Do you like the sound of a jazzy big band? How about something operatic? Maybe something lighthearted.
I'm feeling too good today. I'm feeling the way I shouldn't. I'm feeling too good today.
Hear them all on Big Band Broadway and Beyond. I'm Joe, your host, every Friday from 10 a.m. till noon on WHFR 89.3.
I'm feeling too good today. I got the feeling too good today, blue.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show him you love him. Keep him safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is a special edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw will be back on a future show.
I'm Frances McDormand. You're listening to Building Speak, Stories of Pioneering Women Architects, a new hour-long special from the Kitchen Sisters, the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, and PRX. Let's pick up with the story of Julia Morgan.
Julia Morgan mentored via her women's clubs and YWCAs, which were central to young women leaving their family farms and coming into cities to allow them to work but not have to live in an unsavory boarding house full of traveling salesmen. YWCAs were essential, and she literally built more than a dozen.
This historic building, designed by renowned architect Julia Morgan, first opened its doors to the Chinese Young Women's Christian Association, YWCA, in 1932. My name is Justin Hoover. I'm the executive director of the Chinese Historical Society of America in San Francisco. The use of architectural detail, today we see that as a sense of Orientalism, but at the time it was a way for people of the Chinese culture to share their culture with Westerners in America.
I think a combination of the Great Depression and the war, which really set back the architecture industry for a significant amount of time, then the stylistic changes post-war. There comes a point in the leading edge of American architecture where everyone wants it to be about modern forms, stripping out the ornament. And that was not something that Julia Morgan ever really did. She closed down her office when she was losing clients. And then she just lived largely alone in her apartment. Her own ill health meant that she spent the last two decades of her life slipping from the center of architecture. When she died, you know, it was written up in the San Francisco Examiner. She was known in her city, but it wasn't like her work was in the air. It wasn't like people were writing about it as if it was exciting.
Would you believe that as recently as 1978, when we were discussing the Equal Rights Amendment, that the president of the AIA declared to the press that he would never hire a woman architect? On behalf of these women practitioners, I express our collective and respectful anger.
The times in which people are interested in Morgan also go along with the times in which there's a new interest in women and power and expanding the canon in architecture history.
We are very proud to posthumously award the AI Gold Medal to Julia Morgan, the early 20th century architect whose copious output of quality work secured her position as the first great female American architect.
You're listening to Building Speak, Stories of Pioneering Women Architects. Ada Louise Huxtable.
Our guest tonight is Mrs. Ada Louise Huxtable, architectural critic of the New York Times. Mrs. Huxtable, being an architecture critic is an unusual profession. How did you get to do this kind of work?
There are many publications now anxious to have architecture critics, and there are just very few people with the training. My training was really self-made. I'm an informally educated critic. I'm an architectural historian, and I've always been interested in the city, in all cities.
You've had a fantastic impact on the thinking in New York. I think you're one of the most admired critics that I've ever heard of. Your ability to set some sense of taste in New York City and the kinds of crusades you've been involved in maintaining some of our landmarks have been very notable. I think the people in New York City owe you a real debt of gratitude. Are you a New Yorker or a visiting fireman?
Natalie DeBlois was an architect of great accomplishment who came into the field at a time when few women were in the profession. Men were returning from World War II, the economy was booming. Women's work was mostly at home or in the pink-collar sector and the secretarial pool. This is the world that Natalie DeBlois, with her sophisticated sense of design and engineering, entered and helped upend. During her time at the prestigious architectural firm Skidmore, Owens & Merrill, she helped design some of the landmark skyscrapers that changed the skyline of New York's Park Avenue. Along with her skyscrapers, she also had four children. It's thought that Natalie was the first woman at the firm to be given maternity leave, but her career was no easy road.
What is your name, please?
My name is Natalie DeBlois.
My name is Natalie DeBlois.
My name is Natalie DeBlois.
Two of these people are imposters. Only one of them is real and is the only one sworn to tell the truth.
Natalie handled design challenges with an elegant simplicity that belied their complexity. And like the buildings she designed, there was a complexity to Natalie herself.
All right, panel, will you follow along with your copies of this affidavit? I, Natalie DeBlois, am a registered architect and member of the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architects. I am employed as a senior designer and an associate in the architectural firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. I am currently working as a senior designer on the new block square 50-story high Union Carbide building now under construction in New York. I am married and the mother of four children. Signed, Natalie DeBlois.
A skyscraper visionary ahead of her time. Story number two, Natalie DeBlois, to tell the truth.
Today is March 12th, 2002. And I'm with Natalie DeBlois in her home in West Hartford, Connecticut. We are here together to document, in Natalie's own words, highlights of her remarkable 40-plus years career.
Yeah. 40. Actually, it's closer to 50.
Oh, okay. Much of this career has passed without the recognition it was due. This oral history is intended to shed light, fill gaps in the historical record, and set the record straight.
Natalie DeBlois is an underknown architect who practiced in the middle of the 20th century. I'm Gabrielle Esperdy. I am an architectural and urban historian. I'm a professor of architecture, and I am the author of the Natalie DeBlois profile in the Pioneering Women of American Architecture project.
You said that you knew you wanted to be an architect when you were 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm. How did I know? I liked buildings and houses and plants. And I went to the 1939 World's Fair. I saw modern buildings, and that impressed me enormously. And my father made it clear to me that architecture was a profession where there were only very few women, and he cut out articles in the newspapers and showed me these things. But that had no effect on me, what was going on.
Morris Ketchum's office, what kind of work did they do?
Morris Ketchum had done two spectacular modern shops. They were some of the earliest modern architecture that was built in New York City. I was just so pleased that I was offered a job I started working that winter, January 44.
It was a very small firm. Three young people, her and a couple of men, would hang out together. They would socialize outside of the office.
How do you do, everyone? For our swing fans, Columbia offers you Benny Goodman and his orchestra, coming to you from the Manhattan Room in the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City.
One of the fellows used to take me out dancing to hear Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and wherever they were playing.
One of the guys was enamored with Natalie and upset that she was not acknowledging his advances. And he went to the partner of the firm and told him this and said, I can't work with her. She has to leave because she won't accept my advances.
Mr. Ketchum asked me to come over to his office, and he told me I would have to leave.
So the partner of the firm fired her. Amazing.
And Mr. Ketchum complied. He wrote me this letter and said, due to circumstances beyond his control, she has to leave. He said, I'll call up Louis Skidmore, who's down on the 9th or 10th floor, and see if he has a place for us. So he picked up the phone and called up Louis Skidmore and said he was going to send somebody down to see him.
Even at Skidmore, there were stories that she told about just being, you know, not part of the club. You know, it was a boys' club. I'm Audrey Matlock, principal and owner of Audrey Matlock Architect in New York. She never thought about it, really. She was only interested in the work, so she wasn't looking for advancement or accolades. There were instances where the male partners and clients were having a meeting, and she was in the meeting because she had all the information, because she was the one actually doing the work. And then when it was time for lunch, they were going to some men's club or other, and Louis Skidmore looks at her and says, make sure you're back here at 2 when we're back from lunch. And they walked out without her. And she said she just went in the bathroom and cried. I first met Natalie when I was working at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill back in the late 80s. Natalie was invited to come and give a lecture. After her talk, I introduced myself to her, and she looked me head to toe and said, oh, are you in interiors? I was crestfallen. No, how can you say that? No, I'm an architect. Anyway, we struck up a conversation and hit it off. And that kind of started our friendship.
In 56, I had another child. And Gordon told me, don't show up at that opening ceremony if you haven't had your baby yet.
Why did he say that? Were you an embarrassment to the men?
Obviously.
People were somehow embarrassed by pregnant women. Maybe the idea that, you had sex with somebody. She had an eminent position in the firm because she was a senior designer or whatever they called it. So clearly everybody respected her ability, but it didn't mean that they wanted to hear her speak at a meeting. My name is Carol Krinsky. I'm a professor of art and architectural history at New York University. I wrote a book about Gordon Bunshaft, who was the person who was supervising Natalie DeBloy. Skidmore, Owings & Merrill was established between the two world wars by Louis Skidmore and Nathaniel Owings. After the Second World War, they got the commission to do Lever House. I think that put Skidmore, Owings & Merrill on the map. These young modern hotshots, they all read Le Corbusier, and so they wanted these pristine, prismatic buildings, and then they looked at Mies van der Rohe, who had actually come to the USA. They knew that Mies was building in glass in Chicago before some of these buildings went up in New York, and they didn't want to look as if their buildings were being left behind. The first one was, of course, Lever House on Park Avenue, and it was a shock to everyone. All of a sudden, Lever House appeared, green, with a lot of light around it. When Union Carbide planned to move to Park Avenue, they too wanted a glass building. Then when Pepsi-Cola moved, they also wanted glass buildings.
Natalie's contribution to buildings like Lever House, PepsiCo, Union Carbide, those changed the face of Park Avenue, changed our image of the urban landscape. Because now we see one tower after another after another, and it looked very different, certainly immediately after the war. It is a moment when women were beginning to more explicitly assert an influence on the built environment. Natalie is working on these buildings at exactly the same moment that Jane Jacobs is challenging notions of modernist urban planning, that Ada Louise Huxtable is the New York Times' first architecture critic and who is bringing conversations about architecture into a popular conversation.
One of the things you did do
was Pepsi-Cola.
Oh, yeah.
That was beautiful little building.
Yeah. It has been called in the literature, almost without exception, an elegant jewel box. By 1961, you had four young children and a career at SOM, New York, but you moved to Chicago.
Well, I divorced my husband, too.
Oh, that's not in my notes, but how did you keep all of this in balance, your family and your profession?
I didn't really keep it in balance. I had continual problems with my husband.
Because you were so devoted to your practice?
No, because he was an alcoholic. And it was difficult.
Our family history, it's difficult to talk about. She obviously worked incredibly hard. And as a result, you know, she was no housewife.
My name's Robert DeBlois. I'm the son of Natalie DeBlois.
Natalie, she did not communicate a lot with us. She never talked about her work. When she came home, we would have dinner, would listen to the radio. Neither of my parents would talk to us much. My dad, usually when he came home, I mean, he was an alcoholic. There were a couple of very intense, traumatic incidents that happened. It was about the time of their divorce. And after that, the next thing I know, we had moved out of the house.
Amazing to raise four boys and do the demands of Skidmore. I mean, we never left there until midnight when there was a project going. I'm Margaret McCurry. I'm a partner in Tigerman McCurry Architects. Before that, I was at Skidmore for 11 years, and Natalie was there during the time I was. I learned proportion and detailing and things that were important in creating spaces that are harmonious and beautiful, and that was part of her legacy, too.
Natalie leaves New York and goes to Chicago. Second wave feminism starts to happen, and she backs into a kind of sideline of activism.
Come and meet other female architects regarding Coalition. 9:30 a.m., January 12th, 1974. I'm Carol Ross Barney. I'm an architect in Chicago. I was there when Natalie and Gertrude Kurbis decided to call women together in Chicago. That was the formation of Chicago Women in Architecture. We were really good friends when she quit Skidmore.
I went down there and started teaching University of Texas. I taught for 13 years, 80 to 93.
My name is John Newman. I'm an architect. I went to the University of Texas at Austin, and I had Natalie as a professor there. She would talk to you about really technical issues, about how that doesn't meet the code or that doesn't meet the zoning. She would encourage you to challenge the code. Natalie was sort of there at the beginning of the post-war modernizations of New York City. She talked about riding her bike around New York City after work, going up to the code committee meetings, and she would go, you know, work on building code for a couple hours, and then she would meet Marcel Breuer for drinks. The active New York architects from the 50s and 60s would be at Brasserie at 9 o'clock in the evening. And you know, she would drop in and it would be all these people. And that's just who she hung out with at the end of the day.
I'm Peter Dixon. I'm a senior partner at Profit, a branding and innovation firm. And had the good fortune of being Natalie's student at the University of Texas in 1986 in her tall building studio. The idea of shaping the vertical world was just fascinating to me. The fact that she was doing such iconic work and always be seen as the woman carrying Gordon's bag, so to speak, must have been tough.
The things that happened to her when the Skidmore thing kind of fell apart, she was never made a partner. She didn't hold a grudge. She just went down and started her life over again. And it turned out to be an incredible experience.
Everything about Natalie was quite surprising.
I remember the last time I saw her was here in New York City. Very, very cold day. She had her woolen tights on and her dress and her beautiful tweed coat. And we walked around and looked at buildings in the cold afternoon. Stopped in for a glass of wine every once in a while and then went on to look at some more buildings.
You're listening to Building Speak, a new special from the Kitchen Sisters, the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, and PRX. I'm your docent, Frances McDormand. Glad you're with me. When we return, the amazing story of Amaza Lee Meredith.
Hey, I'm the jumper, the one that wrote that Trailways bus out of Louisiana. Now I'm on that blues plane doing my thing all the way up 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. at night on WHFR 89.3 each and every Wednesday night. Well, hey, you want to stop in and have some fun? We got blues you can use right here on WHFR 89.3 Dearborn.
I've been downhearted, baby.
Take charge of your college experience. The HFC Student Activities Office can help you connect with or start a club, plan and promote events or fundraisers, or even find volunteer opportunities in our community. The HFC Student Activities Office operates 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the fall and winter semesters, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the summer semester. You can find the HFC Student Activities Office on campus in the M Building or call 313-845-9865. That's 313-845-9865.
Speak if we listen. I'm Frances McDormand.
This is a special presentation of the WHFR Journal on the station making waves at 89.3 and WHFR.FM.
You're listening to Building Speak, a new special from the Kitchen Sisters, the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, Trey Schultz, and PRX.
Googie architecture really sprang out of the car culture of Southern California of the 1940s and 50s.
Helen Fong.
Helen is one of the main purveyors of that, and we have her to thank.
Bob's Big Boy, Norm's Restaurant, Clock Drive-Ins, Denny's. That was the big one. We did hundreds and hundreds of Denny's.
The whole era was so exciting. Space age, that futuristic thing.
This was a time when a mass amount of cars were flooding Southern California. You needed to catch the attention of folks driving by at 40 miles an hour and lure them to come get a hamburger or buy a car or go bowling. Eye-catching, modernist, futuristic architecture with bright colors, sharp lines. Helen, she had grown up in Los Angeles at the same time this car culture was emerging. She really had an intuitive eye to know what people driving down the streets wanted to see and what that particular brand of Southern California optimism was and how you could translate it into architecture and design.
She once told me she learned how to fold blueprints by folding laundry as a child.
Helen started off working in her family laundry, you know, a child of hardworking immigrants in Chinatown. You can see some of the traditional Chinese architecture and design in her Googie work. Those bold primary colors, the angular work, is very reminiscent of traditional Chinese design, but with this very futuristic modern twist.
Helen was born here in 1927. The Exclusion Act was not gotten rid of till the early 40s. There were so few Chinese women, period. And then for her to practice in a post-World War II anti-Asian era, we drive by her work all the time. And to not know Helen till now made me feel ashamed as an architect, but also proud.
If you go to the website Pioneering Women of American Architecture, profiles of some 40 groundbreaking, little-known, overlooked architects await you, with photographs, blueprints, sketches of houses built and unbuilt, along with the astounding collection of architect Barbies that Cynthia Krakauer, host of the New Angle Voice podcast, has made of the women in the series. There is the Julia Morgan Barbie in 1800s garb, the Ray Eames Barbie in her 1960s pinafore holding her signature Benson and Hedges cigarette, the Ada Louise Huxtable Barbie poised on a tiny Saarinen tulip chair, a Helen Fong Barbie in honor of the pioneering Chinese-American Googie architect, and an architect Barbie clad in overalls in honor of pathbreaker Amaza Lee Meredith.
People like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois said, look, if you build your own homes, then you will be making a statement. He was encouraging men to go into the architecture field to build for their communities. I'm sure that Amaza Lee Meredith knew about this and contributed in her own special way.
A short bike ride from the Long Island summer haunts of Melville, Steinbeck, Betty Friedan, Spalding Gray, Amaza Lee Meredith created Azurus North in the African-American summer enclave of Sag Harbor that she helped establish with her sister in the late 1940s as a haven for Black intellectuals, artists, and beachcombers. Hundreds of miles south, she also created Azurus South, a low white international house on the edge of Virginia State University, a historically Black college where Meredith and her lover Ed Nicholson both held significant teaching positions. Two professional Black women living openly queer lives in the 1940s through the 1980s. Together, the homes and communities that Meredith helped build and establish provided a sense of place and pleasure for those at a time when this wasn't always possible. Story number 3, Amaza Lee Meredith, Love and Home.
Amaza Lee Meredith is an architect, educator, and artist in the early 20th century. African-American, lesbian, and bold as they come. I'm Jacqueline Taylor. I'm an architectural historian, and I've just turned my dissertation into a book about Amaza Lee Meredith. She saw her role as somebody who was helping the next generation think differently about how to live. She did that through the house that she designed, living openly on the edge of the university grounds with another woman who was clearly her lover. Also, the resort on Sag Harbor in Long Island was a way of saying we can live differently. We can have these spaces.
I first learned about the work of Miss Meredith through Mario Gooden's essay collection, Dark Space, a constellation of Black architecture and Black architectural history. My name is Jessica Lin. I am a writer and art critic. Gooden writes about Amaza Lee's home, Azurus South, on the campus of what is now Virginia State University, a historically Black college, as an example of early Black modernism, and really positions Amaza as an important figure in that lineage. Meredith was born in Lynchburg, Virginia in 1895, the youngest of Emma and Samuel's four children.
Her father had been a builder. He was a white man whose family had been in the construction industry for generations. He had four children with a Black woman. He built them a home, even though it was illegal to live together at that time. He was mostly a carpenter, and so he taught Meredith about design and construction.
When she went to high school, Miss Meredith really wanted to be an architect because her father wanted to be. He was a carpenter who knew a lot about building houses, and she was inspired by that. But she did not know any school that would take her when she finished high school. I'm Grady Powell. I was the pastor of Amaza Meredith. She was one of the most interesting person I've ever met.
In the 1910 census, there were maybe 60 practicing African-American male architects in the entire United States. Period. To be a woman African-American architect was almost unheard of.
She was discouraged from being an architect by her father because he was a white man in the construction industry and obviously knew that it would be very difficult for women, let alone a black woman. And so she said, okay, well, I'll be a teacher like many others. I don't think that Meredith perhaps started out with the idea that she would design a very unique modern house. It all really came about because she developed a relationship with her instructor when she first went to Virginia State University to become a teacher, and Edna Colson was her instructor.
Amaza studies at Columbia, and it's at Columbia when Amaza first starts to correspond with Edna, who at the time is still in Virginia teaching.
She went to New York in 1927. She trained under a young woman called Belle Boaz. Part of that curriculum was to send the students out into the city to view the shop windows where they were displaying new ideas about design and fashion, and to the museums and art galleries to see what the latest ideas were. Meredith was from the South, and African Americans were prohibited from going into museums or art galleries unless they were art galleries owned by African Americans, which were very few and far between. The most significant exhibition she attended was at the Museum of Modern Art, the international exhibition that displayed a lot of these international style buildings. Very free-flowing space, flat roof, very much focused on form, very little decoration, if any at all. I'm sure that she picked up on those ideas and came up with this design. It was very important for African Americans to go north, because there wasn't the education available in the South. I found a letter from Meta Warwick Fuller, who was an African-American artist, who said, we need more people in the arts. I had a sense that Edna Colson had suggested to Amaza Meredith that she study art and help the next generation of black women move out of the service industries and into the new arts professions, graphic design or arts publications, which helped them become part of the professional class. A few years later, Edna Colson and Amaza Meredith decided to move in together. She said, okay, now I'm ready to build that house with you.
Where they lived, Miss Meredith named it Azurest South. Azurest is supposed to be a wonderful resting place.
And there's this little house set off to the side of the campus, kind of in a little bit of a dip. Sort of hiding, but not really. It's painted white with a flat roof, very short rectangular structure made of concrete blocks and has areas where the windows are glass bricks.
That touch of that bold azurist blue at the top that really pops.
It's pretty clear when you see the building in the context of the Colonial Revival campus of Virginia State University. She was making a very bold statement. Modernism in architecture itself was trying to move away from the past. She latched onto this concept of let's move away from the past and create something different because I am different and my way of life is different. In many ways, it was a very private space for her and Edna Colson, but she became more confident over time. She would have workshops in the grounds of the house and have social functions there.
Their home was a wonderful intellectual conversation. I talked about Negro spirituals. She would sing with me. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing
Jacob's ladder. We are climbing.
Miss Meredith had a lifestyle that was different. She would wear overalls to church, but they were happy for her to come in. They talked about it, but they accepted it because she wasn't the only one. But Dr. Edna Colson had a PhD. Miss Meredith headed the art department. so you can't gossip too much. She had a great spirituality. There was another Azurest. Azurest North.
Azurest on this side here, one of the first developments that opened up in 1949 for African Americans. My name is Michael A. Butler. I'm a former president of the Eastville Community Historic Society here. So we're going to turn down here so we can go to the beachfront and you can get a good idea of what that looks like.
Meredith's older sister, Maud, moved north for her to teach special needs in Brooklyn. Somebody she taught with told her about this area called Sag Harbor where it was very easy to vacation. It was very difficult for African Americans to go anywhere on vacation because they weren't allowed to go to certain beaches. They were prohibited from staying in hotels. She went and visited, and then she rented a cottage there and met somebody who was trying to sell some of the land.
Ameza and Maud Terry, they would come and they would find this tract of land and say, listen, we can do something with this. My name is Georgette Grierke. I'm the executive director of Eastville Community Historical Society.
I'm Renee Simons. I'm a resident of the Sag Harbor Village community, and I'm president of the SANS organization. There are three subdivisions within SANS: Mines, Sag Harbor Hills, there's Nineveh, and then there's Azurest. Azurest was founded in 1947. Sag Harbor as a village at that time came out of World War II. It was struggling. Then you had this infusion of folks who had cash, who came in asking, could I buy property? Because of the financial situations of the owners at that time, they said yes. They had to pay cash because banks would not lend to them, no matter how creditworthy they were. And we're talking about people who were doctors and lawyers.
They bought all these pieces of land and then they created what they called a syndicate.
They organized and really plotted out the plots.
They sold monthly subscriptions to their friends and other family members.
Groups like the Divine Nine, that's the sororities, the fraternities, church groups, professional organizations that they belong to, a lot of educators, a lot of artists. They had a network to really pass the word around to build this community. That became known, kind of like the Green Book. This is a place that you can come, you can be welcome. We can have music, we can have poetry, and do all of this freely without being surveilled.
Nemeza designed all these buildings. I don't think any of them were built except one for the family itself and for a friend. But she has a lot of drawings of examples of homes that people could buy and could have built.
My name is Brooke Williams. I am a writer and an activist and a musician. I have been going out to Sag Harbor for my entire life. It became a haven for artists and writers.
Lena Horne summered here for a bit. Harry Belafonte summered here.
Langston Hughes was a regular visitor. Colson Whitehead, the author.
Women have been in the forefront of preserving this place by way of purchasing land, but not only purchasing it, passing it down to the next generation. We are trying to preserve what Ameza and Maud created, that sense of community.
The preservation wasn't even in my head at all. When there were a series of developers coming in, I asked, why are you allowing it here? You didn't consider it in any other part of the village. Then I was told, those areas are more important to us. I said, but why aren't our areas worthy of preservation? You had significant, influential African Americans who lived here over decades that played important roles in America. The gauntlet was down. Like, I'm sitting amongst houses that you are protecting that don't look very much different than our houses.
Some of these homes, they were built by any means necessary with whatever material that they could find. Does that make that less important? No, it should tell the story. They were able to do that because of these two ladies who knew the significance of this place and what it could become today.
My name is Christina Morris. I work for the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Azara South is a perfect example of that. There is such rich history encapsulated in this one tiny little beautiful modern jewel box of a building.
It's very clear that she understood her position as an artist, as an architect, as a partner. She knew her life was valuable, that it mattered. As a Black woman in the South, that was an incredibly important gesture. It's such a push against the record, a push against the silence.
Building Speak was produced by Brandy Howell and the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, in collaboration with Trey Schultz and Nathan Dalton. Mixed by Jim McKee. This PRX special was inspired by the podcast series New Angle Voice from the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation, hosted by Cynthia Krakauer and produced by Brandy Howell. Thanks also to Alexandra Lang, Virginia Eskridge, Ashlyn McNamara, Maren McLeod, and Victoria Rosner. Deep thanks to all the architects, scholars, writers, and historians who helped build these stories. Funding for this project was provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Graham Foundation, and listener contributions to the Kitchen Sisters Productions. Further support comes from PRX. Julia Morgan said, "Buildings speak for themselves." She's right, but once in a while, I get to speak for them too. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. Thanks for listening.
Highway 61, what you gotta do every Friday for the best in blues. 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. if you would please tune your radio in at 89.3 FM Detroit Blues and the best in new blues. Friday 2 p.m. streaming live at WHFR.FM. Henry Ford College broadcast with Highway 61 and DJ Kitty Love making waves.
Highway 61.
You lucky person, you're tuned to the right place. WHFR 89.3, Highway 61 with Kitty Love is next. Direct from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.